First meditation for quartet, John Coltrane, on this day in 1965. This piece was released. This particular piece cut is called Consequences. The great John Coltrane released this piece on this day, September the 2nd, in 1965, before many of you were born. And not all of you. Not all of me either. So, but a great day. So we are here now with our two guests for this roundtable on some of the events that are happening around us. And there are a number of things that kind of struck us that may not be at the very top of the news, but I think that they are kind of very important to look at. One is the arrest of this Dorchester County teacher, Dorchester County, Maryland teacher, Patrick McLaw, who wrote under a fictional name about a school massacre taking place in the year 2900. He was arrested, thrown out of his school, had his house searched. Police will not say where he is. This is like some Orwellian Soviet nightmare going on in our eastern shore. So we'll look at that. We're going to look at the Jennifer Lawrence question and what happened with the nude pictures being posted. But not so much that, but this precarious nature of all of our information in this world today, how easy it is to get anything we want on anybody else if you have certain kinds of knowledge. We'll look at Michael Sam being cut. And what that means, both the arguments taking place back and forth, whether he was qualified, not qualified, was because he was gay or not gay, but it's certainly important that it has gripped the nation, no matter which way that is. And also the latest from Ferguson. People are still marching every day. They took over an entire street marching from Ferguson to the city hall demanding. They move the prosecutor away. It's not lessening. It's just growing. And people are out there in their peaceful demonstrations every day. So join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to my Facebook pages. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We are joined here by Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor at The Root, political contributor and special correspondent with Al Jazeera America. He's a columnist, political analyst, appears on numerous programs, MSNBC, CBS Washington, National Syndicated Radio. Dr. Kay Whitehead is with us, the Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University in Maryland, author of Notes from a Colored Girl, A Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, and that conversation with her about that book will be coming up here in just a couple of weeks on this program. So welcome. Good to have both of you with us.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure to be with you, Mark.
How are you, Edward?
Very good, buddy.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Where do we want to begin? I know that you had a particular interest, Edward, in talking a bit about Michael Sam. Let's start there.
Yes. You know, I was, as you know, I took sort of the month of August off from writing because I was in the Caribbean and then I was in Ferguson covering events there. But I was asked to write about this this weekend and realized how significant it was, but how disconnected I was to it because I felt a bit deflated by it all. It seemed like there was a great deal of promise here, in a way, like looking at almost the racial integration of professional sports when Jackie Robinson entered the Major League Baseball. I felt that we were experiencing that kind of moment with Michael Sam, and it sort of seems to be ending on a bit of a thud. And I'm not quite sure what it means. There's been so much talk from the moment that he came out, I think, weeks before the process began, that he somehow wasn't qualified enough. And yes, he had done really well in the Southeastern Conference, but he wasn't big enough to really be on a defensive line in the NFL. And I felt like they were already writing the story. This sad postmortem was already being written so that when we got to this point, people will have digested it and moved on. And I don't work in professional sports, and I don't know how they evaluate those players, but I can't help but believe that this boy has lost an opportunity because he is gay. And I think it just shows that as progressive as we believe we are, we still have a long way to go, particularly when it comes to these institutions that are built around a certain understanding of what it means to be a man and masculinity, and black masculinity in particular. I'm not quite sure if African Americans in general were ready for Michael Sam in a way that I'm not sure the broader populace may be a bit more progressive on that point. And that just comes from the conversations I've had in my own social circles and family circles and friendship circles. I really believe that that really was the issue here. And I think that that's a sad state of affairs.
I think I'm even more disconnected than you are, Edward, because I am not a football fan. I don't follow it at all. But I did follow this story because I was interested to see how it would eventually play out. I was very concerned with all the pressure being placed upon his shoulders. It reminded me like a Little Rock 9 moment, that you are the one we've been waiting for. So therefore, you have to do more than what you think is possible in order to be accepted. So in looking at this, I don't know what it means to be a 7th-round draft pick. I do know. When I went and researched, the 7th-round draft picks get cut all the time. So it's not unusual. I don't know what it means to actually be inside the locker room as, you know, the first openly gay male to be drafted, the first openly gay male to play in the preseason. I do know there was a series of articles all about his showering habits.
Yes.
And I've never seen that before about a football player. And I kept asking, who cares? We only care because we're talking about his sexuality and the fact that he was brave enough and courageous enough to come out. Knowing if he hadn't come out, somebody probably would have outed him. There was that wave happening as well. I can agree with you that even in my friendship circles and among my family members who I consider to be very progressive, they were extremely concerned about the fact that he was same-sex preference, as if that would impact his play or take away from the game. My argument is that we have same-sex preference players playing all the time. It's the difference is that Michael Sam actually talked about it and brought it to the forefront and therefore made himself a target in so many ways. Perhaps he was cut because of his talent, but because you have this other narrative happening, everything that happens gets taken into question at this point.
And what it does, and you stated that so beautifully and so powerfully, because what it does is it says to all those gay players who are already in the NFL to keep their mouths shut and to find new locks for the closet doors.
Yes.
And I think that is what's problematic about this. Even though we will never really know why he got cut, I think that there's a gut reaction to all of this that basically is still encouraging young boys and young girls to not be honest, to not tell the truth, and to live a life that is ultimately, what is it, what do they have in the military?
Don't ask, don't tell.
To live by that kind of rule.
And I think that there was the ESPN piece, I forget the correspondent's name, when she talked about him being in the shower. And that was kind of weird. I mean, that kind of set a tone, I think, for this whole thing, and says a lot about where people are in their conscience about this. And I said, you know, I would say to my my friends often, I said, well, you know, if you've taken a collective shower in high school or college or doing sports or anywhere else, chances are there were a number of gay men in that shower with you.
I just want to...
You know, it's like we need to just get over this and just...
I think that's easier said than done. I want to add to what Edward said is that we have now kind of taken this whole movement back. You need to keep your mouth shut if you want to be successful. You need to keep your mouth shut if you want to be accepted. That there are certain communities, particularly in sports, these sports where you have a lot of masculinity, a lot of testosterone, where it's all about being a real man, and you go out and you play football to hurt the next person, not just stop them from making a touchdown, but you get, you know, pats on the back for hurting the other person. I think in these type of fields, we're now teaching young boys, moving beyond Michael Sam, thinking about the next generation of young boys who are playing sports, that it's still not okay to be fully open about who you are, not just when it comes to your sexuality, but across the board. We're now silencing that field yet again.
Yes.
So folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to me here, talk@steinershow.org. Your thoughts on all this, on Michael Sam and more. And let me move on to another subject here before try to get a couple of things on the table and come back to some of these subjects. Before we get to Ferguson, which I really want to talk about because there's so much going on there, and you were just there, Edward, and I've been talking to people who were there, and we're going to continue our coverage here, Ferguson. There was a story that really kind of grabbed my attention just because it's kind of frightening. And this took place in Cambridge, Maryland, Dorchester County, Maryland, Cambridge, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore, Cambridge of civil rights fame, a town with a black mayor whose father was a civil rights leader, but all the positions of power still very much controlled by a conservative white world in that town. They had a teacher named Patrick McLaw. He's written two books under aliases. was teacher of the year for some of the students, mm-hmm. helped students get their books published, taught them how to do that online by themselves. By all accounts, an incredible teacher who published under the name of Dr. K.S. Voltaire, tongue-in-cheek. And one of the books he published was about a school massacre, 900 kids being killed in the year 2900. They suspended him from school, pushed him out of the school, not allowed to come in. Police arrested him. They're not saying where he is. Is he under arrest? Is he... Nobody knows where he is. His house is searched and ransacked by the police. And he's been sent for psychiatric evaluations. They're looking for guns in schools. I mean, this is like Orwellian madness, and it's pretty frightening. I mean, it's happening here in 2014 in Maryland in the United States.
Well, I had two reactions to this, and I'm sure that neither of them were very popular. But I had a gut reaction as a parent, and I thought, as I read through this story, that if this was my son's teacher, writing under an alias, K.S. Voltaire, I know it was tongue-in-cheek, publishing books, even though they're sci-fi books, I love sci-fi books about school massacres in the culture that we live in, coming after Columbine, coming after Adam Lanza, I would not agree that they with what they did do, going that far with it, but I would be very concerned as a parent, and I would want to find
out. Why would you be concerned?
Because in this culture, is this a cry for help? Is he beginning to talk about things that he's imagining? You're in there with my children. You're in there where the doors are closed and things have happened in the school. Perhaps if we had responded earlier to some of the things that were put out by the boys from Columbine, if somebody had interceded early with Adam Lanza, even though this is just sci-fi and you're writing, I would want to have a conversation with the teacher, not get the teacher arrested, but I want to talk about it. Okay, now, where did this come from? Like, what are you doing with this next? Why is it under this pseudonym? Why are you not putting out under your name? What are you having this conversation? Just taking place in the classroom? Are you talking about it with the students? That was my first reaction as a parent. As a former Baltimore City teacher, I was very alarmed because I'm concerned that there's no freedom to be able to express yourself, that he shouldn't have to write under a pseudonym. He should be able to express himself. This is fiction. This is sci-fi. It's set in the year 2900. He's not talking about what he's going to do today or what he's even going to do. It's about characters that he's developed. So I had two very opposite reactions that I tried to understand for where I'm going, even as a writer, as a researcher. Am I free to talk about the things I want to talk about that might make people feel uncomfortable, but that might result in me being arrested? I mean, I'm a professor. I teach young people. So I was kind of torn on that.
And people do, I mean, I think Edward all the time write under pseudonyms. I mean, I was talking to a young potential writer the other day about this name that she wanted to use rather than her name she thinks would catch on more. Mm-hmm. And people don't want to use their own names for lots of reasons, maintain their privacy. But I mean, I think that one of these things that we've gone so far overboard because of Columbine and Newtown.
Well, I feel like there's a broader issue going on here in our culture. So there is the issue, obviously, of the violence in schools. And I think the school principal and fellow teachers would have a right to be concerned. My problem, and to engage that teacher in a conversation and debate about his work, right? I don't necessarily have a problem with him doing it under a pseudonym because it seems clear that he was honest about his other career, because it doesn't seem like there was anything being hidden here. But what seems to be the real case, and this is why we bring it back to sort of 1984 and Orwellian tactics, is that we have a police state and an invisible police state that is really problematic. So Edward Snowden brought a lot of what goes on at the NSA to light, and I think that people had known that for many, many years, but they didn't understand how vast and pervasive it was. But then we look at Ferguson and we look at the over-militarization of police forces in this country, and we see a nation that's still fighting a war in Afghanistan that's gone on for over a decade. And I wonder if there are broader issues at stake for what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, which is now not just fighting wars, but also fighting shadow wars that have a lot to do with us basically having no more privacy. And I think the NSA and the CIA are all a part of that infrastructure. And the police state is a part of that infrastructure. And those are the questions we really should be engaging in.
I don't think we do have any more privacy. I know that he did not hide his career with this pseudonym, but just even thinking about the conversation we're going to have about the photos,
yeah,
there is no more privacy. I mean, we know exactly who you are, and they're able to find you. So maybe these bigger questions that you're talking about about us having around the militarization of our military, that they're no longer just police officers. They're no longer officer friendlies. I mean, they're fighting a war and they're dressed for war and using weapons of war, even in the streets when we think about Ferguson and even in Baltimore in certain cases, that what are these bigger questions around privacy, around protection, but also around safety, that we want them to not be in the, we don't want them to be extreme with Ferguson, but we also want to be protected. So what's that balance that we're trying to get, which I think is kind of hard to achieve?
I just think that this was frightening to me, that, that a school system would, I mean, let a teacher go, refuse to allow him in school, the state's attorney of that county wasting taxpayers' money to investigate this teacher because he wrote about a massacre of 900 students in the future. I just think that it's, you know, and we think that everything now is a cause for somebody being mentally unbalanced. Maybe they were going to do this. I mean, it's just, it's a very frightening place for you, where you're afraid.
I would say this, Mark, though. I mean, I'm not sure if you, have you been able to read any of the excerpts from this book?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, is it so gratuitous that it would be almost sort of like the written version of a snuff film? Like, is it,
no.
Like, what was it that was so... yeah, I guess that's my question, because I if I don't know the nature of what was written, I can't necessarily make a decision about how much they should have necessarily been concerned about the safety of those students.
He wrote about this massacre that took place, being the largest massacre in the history of the United States since the year 2900. I'm trying to find the excerpt that I was reading. And how now the federal government has to be called in. Why did this happen? They don't know who did this. And I guess, you know, he's what he does in his work is attempts to make kind of think, and I have not read his work thoroughly, but I wouldn't mind checking it out. But he seems to be the kind of sci-fi writer making social commentary about the world we live in now, but putting it 500 years, 800 years in the future.
Okay.
You know, and that's what he's doing. And I think that, you know, he's, and the fact is he's self-published and he's actually helping his students learn how to publish their own work.
Right, he did help a student publish a book on Amazon. But I understand why the cops were called in. I mean, and why
I
do. Well, the parents were concerned. There were a lot of parents who were saying, are my children safe? So as a way of making them feel safe, you have police presence. Oh, we're protecting your children.
That's where we're being overly...
But I think
that's where our society has gone way overboard.
So the question
fear
is,
about,
we have this fear. I mean, there was a great piece I mentioned to you earlier in the Washington Post, an op-ed, that Ferguson is not about black rage. It's about white rage, which comes from this place of white fear, the fear of black people, the fear of the body of black men. So we have this situation that is not about black people with this teacher, but you have this fear. Are my children safe? Why do I have this fear? Because I have so many true incidents that have happened where my children were not safe. Not my children, but other children. So I want to know, whoever this teacher is, he's publishing this information. Are my children safe? It could have just been a conversation that the principal had with the teacher.
It
didn't have to go that far.
That seems egregious, and it seems like a violation of his civil rights.
And where is he now? That's the question.
And they won't say where he is.
They won't say where he is at this moment.
I just
that's a concern. It's a huge concern.
And I guess I have a huge knee-jerk reaction to these kind of things.
Yes.
Because I just worry about our freedom of press. I worry about our freedom of speech. I worry about the ability of teachers to teach what they want, that everything we write now is going to be looked at suspect if it's about anything to do that's kind of sexually gratuitous, or if it's about violence in our schools. And
And it's the thought police. Everything that George Orwell prophesied. Also, can I ask one question? Was this teacher white or black?
I have no idea.
I'm good.
Because if he were a white male, I think it would be an interesting conversation to talk about. Are we now profiling white males as mass killers?
No, wait. My producer just said over that he was black.
He was black.
Okay.
Or is black, not was.
Yeah, it's black. We're assuming that they've just, they're holding for holding. We're assuming he's still alive.
Well, now that adds a whole entire another layer.
That's another
given
layer.
This is Cambridge, Maryland.
Yes. Oh, that's a whole different layer.
Where a black woman was named mayor of Cambridge, Maryland, elected on her own right, but every piece of the power structure in that city and county, whether it's the fire department, all the clerks, everyone else working there, police department, are white. So
Now, I just want to add, this also says something about me, because my assumption after reading this was that he was white, since they didn't give the color. They didn't give the color.
And I thought, well, maybe they should be concerned about him.
What, black folks don't write science fiction?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking white. I'm sorry. I'm just messing with you.
We have to take a very brief break. Alan, you're in the first caller when we come back. We're going to tie this to Ferguson and to the leaking out of these photos of actresses and where we are in America with our privacy and what Ferguson says all this. I think they are all interrelated. What do you think at 410-319-8888? Welcome back, and that's He's Gone by the Grateful Dead. The song was written about their former manager, Larry Hart, who was arrested on this day in 1971 for stealing $70,000 from the band. He was also Mickey Hart's father, the great drummer Mickey Hart. He was his father. We went out with Horace Silver, by the way, I'm going to tell you. Song from my father, the great Horace Silver, born on this day, September the 2nd in 1928. 410-319-8888. We're here with Edward Wyckoff Williams and Kay Whitehead, tapping a number of issues. Let's go to the phones, and then this new wrinkle added into this guy. We can do our best to find out what happened to him. Over the next couple of days, I intend to call the mayor of Cambridge and others in Cambridge when we get off the air today to see what's going on. People are picking this up all around the country right now. 410-319-8888. Alan, you're on the air.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
Very well, Alan. Welcome.
Yeah, I write pulp fiction. I have been writing pulp fiction for a good long time. And I'm kind of looking over my shoulder, because my first short story is Mike and Mary and Meet the Angel of Death. There are a number of instances where people are killing each other or committing suicide. And in my book, Slug has GIs killing their commanding officers. So this, even though this is fiction and I do not encourage this kind of behavior, the fact that, like, pulp fiction writers like myself and maybe Quentin Tarantino is much better than I am are now going to be put onto the magnifying glass, because we aren't writing stories that are considered acceptable, because we're talking about violence, and a lot of our stories are very violent.
Right.
Will this put us under the magnifying glass? And I'm going to continue writing, and I have a new book coming out soon that will continue to be that. But the fact that in my book, Slug, there are soldiers killing, soldiers deserting to the other side in the Vietnam War, and soldiers killing their commanding officers, kind of makes me afraid they might be coming after me.
Alan, thank you so much. Let's get a quick call here, then move to subject, move on. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah. Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm listening. To be fair, I didn't hear the whole conversation about this particular issue with this student or with this teacher, so I can't make any major comment because I didn't listen. But if you want to talk about the thought police, maybe you should talk about some of the things that some of the so-called civil rights people are talking about. So recently, I could try to give you two quick examples. Recently, I don't even remember what city it was, what school district it was, but some student, I think they were like 9 or 10 years old, sneeze in a classroom, and another student, a lot of reactions where they say, it's kind of stupid, but they say, God bless you. And the student was suspended because they said that, and basically were saying, it's not right. That's wrong for a person to use a statement like that in the classroom because it doesn't allow for diversity. And one other quick one. So some rural state, there was a parade, Memorial Day, I believe, and some guy, and you know, you always say white guy like it's derogatory, like, oh, it's white people are stupid.
That's how you take it. It's not.
So anyway, listen.
So you start yelling, I'm going to hang up. Bruce, raise your voice again. You're off the air forever with us.
Makes some little float on the back of a pickup truck and the outhouse, where he's mocking the president, Barack Obama, because Obamacare, And Eric Holder found it, said it was racist and offensive. And even if it was tasteless, that's fine. But it's also called satire, free speech, and political speech. And Eric Holder said, sent out investigators from the Justice Department to talk to this guy because he was offended. He didn't use any racial epithets. He didn't call the president names. He mocked him. I mocked other presidents as well as Barack Obama, and I voted for him in 08.
Okay, Bruce, thanks. And actually, the student wasn't suspended. I was just looking it up. The student was sent to the office by a teacher who said, we don't use godly words in this classroom. I don't know what that meant. That's absurd, obviously.
Right. But it got out of hand with that with the situation he's talking about, where the student stood up and the teacher responded, and the student responded again, and then the teacher sent the student out. Then the student blogged about it. Then the blog went viral.
Right.
So it did really get out of hand. Again, as a former teacher, when students, it's not just the bless you, it's everything that happens after that that the student doesn't write about. I believe, like what the paper said, there are two sides to this story. And the school is not giving a lot of information because of the privacy of the student, but just bless you is not enough to get suspended. There was more involved than just that.
Edward, any thoughts on this before we move to the next subject?
Yes. yes. So what are we talking about next?
We're just talking about what Bruce was just bringing to the airwaves.
I didn't really have any reaction to anything that she said.
I just want to add to that if folks do want to see an excerpt from the book, it is on Amazon under Dr. K.S. Voltaire,
right.
The insurrectionist, and reading a little bit about it. A number of people are buying it now, and they're buying it.
I hope the sales go way up.
Oh, I mean, the sales are going out of the roof because people are now saying you have to buy it to make a stand against the freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
Before we move on to the next subject, I'm extremely concerned that we do not know where this teacher is.
Right.
The police are not saying where he is, whether he's being held by the police, been put into a mental hospital. They're making all kinds of potential allegations. The police are like walking the halls of the school now, patrolling the school. They found no guns, any other evidence, no warrants about his life. It's been kind of pristine, really. And it says, to me, this is a very frightening situation. I think that we're going to have to – I really want to learn more about this.
I agree. And I want to add on the other side, I do appreciate the principal taking the concerns of the parents very seriously. Not so seriously to have the man arrested, but to at least talk about it. I think that when parents bring concerns, if you are concerned about a teacher that is working with your child 6 to 7 hours out of the day and you take that concern to the principal, the fact that the principal did address it. Yes, I think the principal went too far, arresting, we don't know where he is, the thought police, I agree with all of that. At the same time, on this other hand, it so often happens in schools where parents bring concerns and the concerns are not addressed. The concerns are not realized as something that's important and significant, and things happen as a result of it. So yes, I believe they went too far in this case, but I do like the fact when parents bring concerns to principals, they should be taken seriously. They should
sometimes
be addressed. Not arrested.
Sometimes
not,
I think
missing,
sometimes. But when they have to do with people coming in and complaining about what a teacher's teaching, why are you teaching Darwin? Why are you teaching things that have to, you know,
an inappropriate interaction between teacher and student. Those are the kinds of things.
Right.
I don't know about this. It'll be interesting to see. Yeah.
It'll be interesting
what
how
comes
it plays
of it.
Out.
And I'm glad that you. What I love about you, Mark, you're sort of like a cultural historian and activist all at the same time. And so you bring to light these stories that nobody's talking about, but that speak volumes about where our society is going and where it is. And so I'm interested now in the story.
I want to find out more because that is the town where I was arrested and beaten up when I was 16 years old in the civil rights.
Okay, yeah.
I know this town very well. 410-319-8888.
Well, you actually compared this town to Ferguson, which I think
I
is
did compare the consciousness a lot on the Eastern Shore to the consciousness of Missouri and Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Frank, you're on the air. Good morning, Frank.
Oh, man, I'm real privileged to be able to speak on the subject. I like the point that y'all making, but I heard something early in the conversation where y'all said y'all want to speak on a leakage of some footage. Are we speaking on that now?
Well, go ahead. Bring it up.
All right. Erykah Badu had a video that kind of blew me away, right? And it was like, why would Erykah? Because I got a big crush for Erykah Badu. So I'm like, man, they like, why would Erykah Badu record this video and then put it out there like that? Later on, I guess a couple of months later, come to find out, she said it was leaked. It was supposed to be something personal. So my whole thing is, are these artists actually losing this footage, or is it some kind of promotion scam that we should be aware of?
He's talking about the leaked photos. And
yes, that's what he's talking about, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting perspective on it, because I do wonder sometimes, I mean, we live in this age where, you know, I mean, we're sort of past it, where everyone now not just wants their 15 minutes of fame, but they engineer it. And I think in a world in which Kim Kardashian exists, you always have to question the motives of what kind of information is being put out by celebrities or wannabe celebrities. And so it never occurred to me to question whether or not the photos of that actress, the young actress, were actually leaked or whether they were stolen. I think there are serious questions around the topic regardless, but I think that that is an interesting perspective on it. What if this is all engineered by press and public relations and media professionals to keep these people's names in the headlines? And so we're all sort of responsible when we're buying People magazine and when we're clicking on, you know, media, what is it? There's some media takeout.com, which is one of those websites that leaks a lot of naked photos of celebs and that kind of stuff. We're all engaged in this process of exploitation and now self-exploitation. So I think that there are broader questions beyond just privacy, but also our culture and our need for this kind of exploitive information around people.
I absolutely agree with you. And to just add on the other side, you know, what if it's not leaked? So are we saying that every time you take a picture, it has the potential to end up where you don't want it to
it
end
does.
Up? I mean, that idea that we blame the celebrity, like we blame women when things happen.
Yes.
You know, that
yes.
it's your fault. You never should have taken this photo. But I took a photo for someone. I shared it with that person. And as a way of, you know, revenge porn is what they call it. The person puts the photo out there to all of their friends. And then I become the one because I'm orchestrating this. And I actually did not. I did not look at the nude pictures. I do not plan to do that. I do not feed into that culture. I try as much as possible not to be a part of it, but I am one person. We are in this culture now where everything about you becomes news, becomes gossip, becomes fodder, whether or not you are a Kim Kardashian or whether you are a Kay Whitehead. I mean, I think it's interesting. I use myself as an example. You know, I write op-eds. I do my blog, and I've had people approach me in the grocery stores and want to talk about my kids with me. As if they know me, because they read my blog where I do letters to my teenage sons, and they just assume if I'm blogging about my sons, it means you can approach me at Whole Foods and ask me, how are they doing? How is the baseball? Then I ask questions, well, where did you even get these photos from? These are photos that I have on, say, my private Facebook page. It reminds me, as a communications professor, nothing is private once it goes online. There's no such thing as a privacy setting.
Yep.
Because as soon as you make it private, somebody else can get around it. So because I do put this information out here, it's what you said, Edward. So I orchestrated in one sense. I want you to be interested in my writings about my son so you'll follow along when I blog. But then I want to draw a clear line between writing about my sons for you to read about and then talking about my sons in the grocery store. I think that once you go in one direction, you've, in a sense, lost control of saying how much of your life is private or public. I know the video he's talking about with Erykah Badu, because it was a image of her sister nude showed up, that they did not want this image and this whole video to get out. But I thought for a second he was talking about Window Seat, which is the Erykah Badu video where she undresses in Texas. You know,
yes.
She goes along
and
the
she
route.
She got arrested in Dealey,
she got a,
Dealey Plaza.
Yes, and
right.
I was
right.
absolutely disgusted, because here she is in the middle of the street without, she didn't have any say-so from the police. They did not agree to this, but she's getting undressed across the street from playgrounds.
And the fact that you had to be confused about which video it was.
Yes.
Shows what's so corrosive then about
yes.
our culture. Because on one point, it was a professional job
yes.
she was doing to undress publicly. And on another point, her nudity or the nudity of her sisters is being exploited in some way that she doesn't want. So it becomes a sort of catch-22 in that
it regard. Does. And I did not take her concerns very seriously, to be honest, because what I thought about is I thought about the young people on the playground in the middle of a kickball game coming down mm-hmm. the slide, and there's a woman getting undressed across the street. Who mm-hmm. was protecting the kids from that image? But you are an artist, and you have the license to make this statement. Well, what about the people that are affected by you undressing and walking down the street? What about them?
Well, the question of the pictures that were released, I mean, it seems to me that one of the things it says to us is, I mean, the danger here is for us to think about what we have left. I mean, is that you know, we have the precarious nature of all the information around us, about us, is always out there. And I think that you cannot protect yourself anymore, because if you can be hacked, everything you have can be laid bare, no pun intended. And I think that's what this is about, really, and also just about women. Yeah. And women on display as sexual toys and all the rest. I think that kind of this whole question of whether it's the teacher in Cambridge, Maryland, and this right to freedom of speech and other people's right to have freedom for their own privacy. I mean, these things are getting all connected. This world we're living in is so connected. There's nothing we can do anymore to turn away from what we're plugged into.
Mm-hmm.
We're always plugged in.
And it is difficult to try to even think about unplugging. I mean, it seems like the only way is to go in the opposite direction, like my mom, where you don't even have any of the technology, which if anyone is involved as a teacher, if you are a researcher, if you are doing commentary, it is hard not to be plugged in. And it is a full-time job. If you're running, you know, your Facebook page and your Twitter and you're doing LinkedIn and you're doing academia.eu, every part of you is out there because you think it's helping your career, or you want to spread your message.
So speaking,
or you want to stay relevant.
You want to stay relevant.
On top of things.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you speak of the digital age, let me switch gears here. Then we'll go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Mike, you're the next caller up. We're going to come right to your call, which is when you look at this new modern technology, this social media that we have, that's where the story lived for Ferguson.
Yes.
The story still lives behind those scenes where people were tweeting and shooting and putting things online. There was a march yesterday.
Yes.
Was it yesterday when the march?
There was a march yesterday and a march on Saturday where they prayed with their feet.
And they marched and took up the entire highway and walked up to City Hall.
There were churches.
And you were just there, correct, Edward?
Yes, I literally was just there. And I was at the funeral as well. And we I met Michael Brown's mom, and we were going to interview her, but it was just hours after she had viewed his body. She was in pieces. I mean, quite literally. And so we spent a lot of time with her, Ben Crump, Reverend Al Sharpton. I ended up interviewing, interviewing again Sabrina Fulton, Tracy Martin, and Ben Crump as well. So we got some good footage. We talked to her first cousin, who was one of the ones who spoke at the funeral, Michael Brown's mother's first cousin. Mm-hmm. But it was an experience that I've never seen anything like it. I live this life where we write about things, I get on television and I talk about things. This was one of the first times that I was sent by a television network to cover that kind of event, because this, as you know, Mark, I'm finally getting here at this point in my life, right?
Right.
So it was all new to me, and I didn't expect it to be as emotional as it was. It was very hard also to see the kind of poverty, black poverty, that exists in the South and Midwest. It's something that, you know, I understand, you know, growing up in Newark, I understand urban poverty, and I understand what people think of as ghettos, you know, traditional ghettos like in Brooklyn or the Bronx or Harlem. The poverty in the South and the Midwest is stark in a way that I did not expect. And the lack of education and resources, it made sense to me why these people were rioting, because they literally, like Dr. Martin Luther King said, are the unheard. But not just unheard, but they are unseen. Mm-hmm. And I think when you visit violence upon those people, they have nothing to lose. And so they begin to riot out of that, you know. And thank God it's now turned toward a peacefulness. And I love what she just said about them praying with their feet. That image alone is just so beautiful. But what's happening there in a socio-political sense that predated the murder of Michael Brown is a sad state of affairs about where we are in this country when it comes to poverty,
right?
Deeply, deeply, deeply entrenched poverty. And I think that's the true story out of Ferguson. That and also this over-militarization of police. Those are the real stories here.
And it will be interesting to see how it's going to continue to play out. I did not go down to Ferguson for the Black Lives Matter ride that took place. I had a number of colleagues from all over the country that converged in Ferguson.
A lot
this
of
weekend.
Academics as well.
A lot of my colleagues went down to Ferguson.
Do you know Darnell Moore, by the way?
I do know Darnell Moore. I'm Facebook fans with him.
He wanted me to come out, but I had literally just flown back from it.
But he had, he followed all the way through. Darnell Moore and Stephanie Troutman and Trevor Linson, all of them were talking about
it. You should get him on.
You should. Darnell Moore is exciting. But he was talking about it on Twitter, and I'll make sure I give you his information, on Facebook. But this idea that what do we do? What you said, Edward, they were previously unheard, unseen.
Unheard. Yeah,
but,
thank you for saying that.
But with this idea that they can no longer be silent or silenced. So you go with people who live in these entrenched, poverty-stricken neighborhoods, but then you bring in all these academics, all these researchers, these middle-class African-Americans from around the country to ensure that they are not swept under the rug once the dust settles and the tear gas stops and the rubber bullets end, but that this Ferguson issue, which is now not about Ferguson anymore, it is about these communities where they don't have a voice, where they feel like they are unheard, unseen, that they're not listened to, that they don't have anything at all to lose, including their person. That we are now having these conversations because Ferguson could easily be where this teacher was, could easily be Baltimore City, could easily be Southeast D.C., Harlem, New York. It can smolder and fester. And now you have these academics and others, of course, coming back from Ferguson, going back into their community saying, let's have the Ferguson conversation, which is about being seen and being heard. Let's have it here. Perhaps we need to take to the streets as well.
Yeah.
Let me open the phone show again at 410-319-8888. Join us here with your thoughts. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. And Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, Mark. I thought I detected some intellectual honesty on the Mark Steiner Show, especially coming from the communications professor when she spoke about Michael Sam's preference, not compulsion or
orientation.
So I thought I'd call in. And my question to the professor is this. What would you think is more important to protect children from? The intrinsically pornographic, lewd, and lascivious conduct of Michael Sam kissing his boyfriend on television where children can see it, or a woman just immodestly undressing in front of children?
Well, actually, I'm so glad you raised that up because it's both of them. If you have a problem with Michael Sam openly kissing the person that he loves, and you also have a problem with Barack Obama openly kissing his wife, you also have a problem with my father openly kissing my mother. If you have a problem with people showing affection and that turns you off and that bothers you in some sense because they are of the same sex, then you probably should turn your television off and probably move back into the 1950s because that world has changed and people are free to openly express themselves and express love to one another. As for Erykah Badu taking her clothes off on the street, I do have a problem with that because those young people did not agree to that. They were on the playground and she's stripping to make an artistic point. They see love being expressed all the way around them. What she was doing was not an act of love. She was taking this artistic license to make a point and then getting upset when other video leaked. So it's two different extremes that I believe the caller's talking about.
Yes, and thank you so much for dealing with that so articulately. And let's be clear that a man kissing another man that he's in a relationship with, or a woman kissing another woman, or a man kissing a woman that they're in a relationship with, does not rise to the level of public nudity.
Yes.
So to try to correlate those things is just wrong, basically.
Well, some people are just terrified of any kind of sexuality or sensuousness because it might lead to dancing. What?
Because it might lead to dancing.
Love that.
So, love it.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. So, but I think that what we were saying earlier was that when you look at what's happening in Ferguson at the moment, and I think that there's a connection being made across the country here, and that's the connection that is increasingly powerful, and it's beyond. Whether or not it's on MSNBC and Al Sharpton Show or whatever else, this has to do with people across the country connecting. Here in Baltimore, when Tyrone West was killed at the hands of the police, His family has kept up a vigil every Wednesday. Mm. Hundreds of people supported them in the streets. And it's not covered by the national news, but this is a family who will not let go.
Right.
Until the answers are the way they want them about what happened to their son and their nephew, their grandson. And this family, Tawanda Jones, his sister, and I think his uncle as well, George, ended up going to New York because Eric Garner, right? Eric? Mm-hmm.
Yes, Eric Garner.
Eric Garner's family asked them to come up to walk with them in Staten Island. And so, you know, so I think that there's these connections are being made.
All
and people are beginning to, it to me, it's all tied to that. I think that when you look at, I said this on the air last week, when you look at ever since 2008, when Barack Obama was elected president of the United States, the issues around race in America have become heightened, not lessened.
Yeah, they have.
Yes, they have.
And things are coming to the fore. And I think that there's a dialogue to be had because people even of like minds don't completely agree on everything, but know what has to end. I think this is a very special time that's happening right now, that sometimes when these hard things happen, young man loses his life, it opens these doors for the nation to kind of wrestle with things they haven't with, they did not want to wrestle with before.
I agree with that. I think in wrestling with that and seeing what's happening as a result, if I'm not mistaken, I saw footage of Jordan Davis's parents. I believe they were in Germany speaking like before the UN and talking about violence against young people. I think that as we begin to further have these conversations around white rage, around white fear, around police brutality, around the criminalization of the black male body, we should also include in that conversation the war that we're fighting in our own communities with black-on-black crime. Like we pull out, you know, the Trayvon Martin or the Eric Garner or the Ezell Ford, the young man that was shot at Walmart for holding up the toy gun. You know, we put out Eric Garner. At the same time, there are hundreds of black men that are being killed within their own communities with this black-on-black crime. We should march about that. We should talk about that, and we should address that.
I agree that we should be talking about violence. I don't think we should be using the term black-on-black crime. I think, but one, you know, white males kill more white males in this country than black males kill black males.
Yes.
That's a fact that, you know, that's just a fact. And the, you know, FBI statistics and DOJ statistics show that white males commit the vast majority of violent crimes in this country across racial groups. So I think that we continue to criminalize the black body by using terms like that that are almost designed in an Orwellian sense to convince us of a more violent nature of black people. That simply is not the case. But there is violence happening in this country at every level across racial groups that is now, that is, it's so pervasive, and we have a police culture that we've now been talking about and an over-militarization of police that encourages that culture, and we have poverty in this country that is going unchecked and unresolved because we have policymakers in Washington unwilling to deal with these issues for fear that a black president might be successful. So there's a lot that must be discussed, but we must guard ourselves against this instinct in us to criminalize and over-criminalize black people, even when we are doing it to ourselves.
We have run out of time, but I do want to thank you both for being here. It's been a really excellent conversation. Just heard Edward Wyckoff Williams. We'll be linking to all of his work here on our website. He's an incredible new work with Al Jazeera. And Dr. Kay Whitehead, Communications Affiliate Assistant Professor at Loyola University of Maryland, author of the wonderful book, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Mark and Edward. Thank you.
A pleasure.
It was
Take care, everyone. We'll be in touch soon. And we're going out with the message by the by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. On this day in 1976, they because this is the first rap act to play at a major venue, we knew their first major gig at the Audubon Auditorium in Harlem. We'll be right back with Soundbites.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how.